I'm going to ask you a difficult question. Do you feel like there are parts of your culture that you've had to leave behind in order to get where you are?
Oh, God. Ooh. Okay.
Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. And today we are joined by Janice Torres. She is someone that we've known for years.
Yeah.
She is a now published author. She is a podcaster. She is a creator. She's a speaker. She does all things, and she does all of them really, really well. But today we're talking about her new book, Financially Lit. Now, I want you to think back that there was a time where there was not a book specifically for Black professionals talking about money in their careers. And we saw that and said, hey, instead of waiting for somebody else to do it, we're going to go ahead and write it. Now, if you're a Latina, you might be asking yourself that same question. Why is there not a book specifically for me written by someone who understands my lived experience? Janice asked herself that question and did the exact same thing.
Yeah, the full title of her book is Financially Lit, The Modern Latina's Guide to Level Up Your Dinero and Become Financially Poderosa. My Spanish is terrible, but y'all know what I mean. The point is, she is unapologetically writing this with a person in mind, with a group of people in mind. And her story, even in the episode, as we get into culture and the impact and her reasons for wealth building and what she's learned about herself along the way, is just what we need more of in the world. And so I encourage you to listen to the episode, buy the book, buy a couple of copies of the book, bring her into your office, bring her into your groups. She has a story that needs to be told, and we're happy to have played a part in just this small interview today. So enjoy.
I think the first thing I just have to say is congratulations on everything. Really.
Yeah.
It's not just
the book.
It's everything that you've been building. This feels like a full circle moment for us because, you know, as I think back to when we first met or when we first found you on the internet, and I think there was just like an immediate vibe. It was like, she's this type of person.
She gets it.
Yeah. We like what she's doing. We like the way that she's approaching it. And also just what she represents, because we kind of felt like there was something missing in the space. And I think we saw something that you saw, and you probably, you know, probably meant more to you that you didn't see it and what you represented. And so now here we are years later, you know, after writing about your story in our book and now seeing that you've written your own book and now have built your own community and your multiple businesses and you're doing so well. So we just wanted to say,
real estate investor. I mean, you just keep
on going. What I don't want to do is, I really don't want to waste time talking about kind of little stuff. Like, I really want to kind of skip past that and kind of give you the swag and the credit that you deserve. What's your favorite way of making money at this point?
Ooh, that's such a good question.
Because it comes in, I have a favorite. I'm just curious about what your favorite is.
I think honestly, it is the blog income, because that is the origin story of this whole thing. And it is absolutely what let me quit my job, what let me become financially independent. It was my first foray into entrepreneurship and understanding the power of content creation and just sharing stuff online and somehow getting paid for it. So for me, every time I get one of those checks, I'm just like, is this for real? Like, I feel like I have unlocked the matrix and I just need more people to know about this.
And that's exactly it. Cause I had a feeling, I started to use the word unlock, you know what I mean? And I really want to talk about that. Like, what does it feel like to have unlocked the matrix, to kind of use your language? Because again, there was a time where, like us, like you, you were perfectly fine making $75,000. You thought that that was, you thought you unlocked the matrix then.
Right.
So do you ever look back to the old matrix like, damn, that's actually, that's kind of whack? Or is it embarrassment? Like, what do you feel? Like, when you think back to where you were, right? Like, how does it feel now that you've unlocked this new level?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you just don't know what you don't know. And so I was told, you know, the path to success, go to school, get the degree, get the corporate job, get the pension, all those things. And it just didn't feel like I was using this limited time on earth in the best way possible. I don't know. I feel like I've always just had like this existential, there must be something more than this. And I didn't know how to reconcile that with just this very narrow view of what it means to be an adult and what it means to be a human and what it means to be living in a capitalist, you know, society. And so I'm like, there will be many versions of me and what I prioritize just based on what's going on in my life. And I think the thing that happens to a lot of people is that they get so stuck on the autopilot, on there's only one way to do this, that when they see somebody else who's potentially giving them an alternate path, it's either a scam or, yeah, that's great for them, but that's never going to happen for me. And there's just this really limited perspective that will keep a lot of people from even investigating, like, hey, what is going on over there? Let me go find out. Let me go just like expand my horizons. And so I'm hoping that by being out here and being a visible example of like what it looks like to take the path less traveled, that other people will say, you know what, I'm going to give my own dreams a shot and see if like I'm not down for, you know, what society has told me I should prioritize. I got to redefine that for myself.
Yes. Like we tell your story in our book, and I know you, you know, give more details in your own book. But if you think back to your days when you were traditionally employed, was there a moment where you realized that you just need to get after it? Because I think a lot of people live with the realization that there is more to this. Everybody kind of knows that, where it's like, look, there's more to this, but I'm grateful for what I have right now. In some of us, there is a moment where you're like, there's more, and I think I can get it. Like, I think I can get a little piece of that. Was there a day, a time, an event that caused you to flip that switch?
Well, if I'm being 100% honest, like very early into my career, I was just like, is this it? Like the 6 a.m. wake ups and the 2 hour commutes and the half hour lunch and the 2 weeks of PTO. Like, is this what this was for?
For 4 years?
Yeah. If you're lucky, you know?
Right.
And I don't know, something about the whole situation just really did not sit well with me. And I think there was just always this inner rebel streak that made me question, like, why do things have to be the way they are? I was always that kid who was asking my parents, like, but why? You know, and like nobody would ever give me an answer. And so I feel like when I became an adult and I had some money, I had the power to start asking that question, but why? You know, and so I think for me, the biggest catalyst for what you see today is definitely the first and only time I was laid off in corporate. So it was about 7 years into my career. And, you know, I had a quote unquote stable career, very lucrative industry, pharmaceuticals, biotech, like this is where people go to make money and retire. And then all I saw was acquisitions, mergers, layoffs, consolidation, switching people from full-time employees to contractors so they didn't have to pay benefits. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, wait a minute, this is not the safe, stable thing that I was told doing this corporate thing was going to look like. And so when I was, you know, confronted with that own situation myself, I think there was an automatic like, oh, I gotta be my own safety net here, because these people will give you 30 minutes and a severance check and send you on your way. And that's exactly what happened to me.
You decided to zag. You could have just stuck it out. Like the reality is you help and have built a community of people, but you have reached far more people than have been willing to join you in terms of guiding them in towards another direction. I'm looking at the video right now. I know what those sticky notes are in terms of the people that are part of your community, right? So what do you know about those people that you can say is unique about them, because they decided, because a lot of people deal with that. Some people deal with one layoff, but some people just say it's just a part of the game. And then they convince themselves that it's okay to stick it out, or they buy into a different narrative, which is to say, I need to focus on career development and double down and run faster on the treadmill. And you're like, fuck that. Like, I'm not running on treadmills at all.
Facts. Like, okay. I don't even like running. Okay. I don't like running.
You know what I'm saying? So how, like, what is it that you know, not necessarily about yourself, but like, what is it that you think you understand about the people who get it, the people who make the decision to say one time is enough versus people who kind of need to go through multiple layoffs, multiple rock bottoms before they finally realize that maybe I should do something differently?
Well, you know, I think we do live in a time where we do have way more perspectives that are kind of at our disposal to analyze and consume. You know, obviously with social media, there's just so many different ways that people are living and working and making money. And so I think the fact that people are seeing folks who are not following traditional paths and seeing that, you know, there are people being successful at this, it kind of can turn on a light bulb and be like, well, I could do that. Or, you know, maybe I'm curious about this. But I think if I'm being 100% honest, I do feel like millennials, especially, we are dismantling the American dream as we know it, because we've literally come of age in chaos. And all of the things that we've been told are the keys to success have not led to that, right? So going to school, folks are saddled with student loan debt like never before. Go buy a house. Oh, wait, the economy is going to crash and you're going to lose your home because of Wall Street, you know, greed. Oh, okay. In your highest earning years, we're also going to toss in a pandemic. And then that's going to screw you over for how long, you know, who knows how long. And your earning power is going to be affected because now inflation, and now you'll never be able to afford a home. So it's just like one thing after another has piled up. And I think there is this collective sense of like, y'all, this is bullshit. Whatever they told us to do, the boomers had a different world that they grew up in. They had different access to resources and tools. And we need to redefine what success looks like, what work looks like, what living looks like, what building wealth looks like. And I think there's more and more people who are open to redefining that dream because honestly, for a lot of people, it's turned into a whole ass nightmare.
Right. I think what you're describing is this culture of truth telling, like actually leaving this fairy tale, the story, the dream behind, and telling the truth about our experiences. And you're right. It's led by a lot of vocal people online where there is no gatekeeper. You don't have to ask permission to tell your truth. You can just tweet whatever's on your mind or write whatever's on your mind anytime you want to. But when you enter the world of traditional publishing, and I don't know if this was your experience, but it was certainly ours, there is a layer of whitewashing that is almost it's not forced on you, but it's highly suggested when you are trying to tell.
And sometimes it's just natural, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a true reflection of just who they are, their experience, what they've seen, what they believe they understand.
Yeah. I don't know that it's necessarily in malice. It's just something that we're saying something that is so counter to what they've experienced.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if your gangster ever got tested when you were writing your book, because you told the truth in your book too, just like you're doing now. But I've heard other authors say that they experienced this when they were writing. We experienced it to an extent. And I'm curious about, you know, when it came time to take this same energy and put it in the pages of Financially Lit, was it difficult for you at all?
You know, I think I've had sort of a serendipitous experience in this whole process of writing a book because I was very intentional about the team that I put together before this any words were put on paper. So from my book proposal coach to my agent to my editor, they've always been very clear on who I am, like from day one. And it's like, if you're going to get behind this shit, just know. This is what's happening. Okay. We're not even going to have this discussion about why this book needs to be written. We're not going to have a discussion about why I love to use the F-bomb. Like, we're not going to talk about that, because if you know anything about my brand, you should do enough research before you come here and try to make money off of me. Because let's be honest, that's what everybody does when they're hopping on the bandwagon to help you put out a book. Everybody's trying to get their coins. So it's like, if you're going to invest in this brand, understand that you're investing in the brand as you see it today. Not as some like vision you're trying to push it into. We got enough of the Dave Ramseys of the world. We don't need any more of that content. Clearly, there is a demand for this information. Clearly, this audience matters. Clearly, this audience is willing to spend money. So if you're with it, and if you're not, like, let's just move on. And so I think it's been an incredibly supportive experience for me. I think obviously the fact that my editor is a Black woman says a lot. Everybody who's worked on this book is a woman, which I think has also been to the benefit of, you know, my community, but nobody ever told me, it was like, oh, you know, you might be pushing the envelope here a little bit, because it's just like, you got to understand what you're signing up for. And, you know, I shouldn't have to be the one to convince you why you need to be involved, because I know that if it's not you, somebody else is going to hop on the bandwagon. So figure it out.
Who did you have in mind when you were writing the book? Who are you thinking about?
Oh, God. Janice graduating from high school, who, like, you know, just thought, let me go get a scholarship. Let me go get the degree that's going to make me a lot of money. Let me go work for that Fortune 50 company. And I'm never going to struggle and I'm never going to feel, you know, dissatisfaction of any kind. This is the book that I wish I'd gotten on my high school graduation. And that's honestly what I envisioned for this book to be. When I was thinking about, like, you know, you have to do market research as part of this process and show to the publisher, like, why this book needs to exist and what's the existing content out there. A, there was no book marketed towards Latinas and personal finance. It was a very easy argument to, you know, make. But at the same time, you know, I've taken a look at kind of other books that have been written even by folks in my own community. And I didn't want this to be like a beginner's guide because we got to start talking about some shit other than like paying off some debt and making money. Okay.
Intermediate subjects.
We got to talk about like grown folks stuff. Okay.
Yes.
And so I wanted this book to be like, if I only write one book in my life, which, you know, this shit is hard. So I don't know. if I only write one book, I needed to have everything in it. And I used Ramit Sethi's I Will Teach You to Be Rich kind of as that North Star of just like, I want 17 editions of this book. If I never have to write another one again, we'll just update information as it comes out. And I want it to be something that guides you throughout your financial journey. Whether you're just starting out, you want to negotiate your career, you want to save your emergency fund, or you want to get a prenup or create an estate plan or sign up for life insurance. Like, this book is going to walk you through every possible financial scenario you're going to encounter, regardless of your age. And I want it to be inclusive in that way.
I want to dig a little bit deeper because you were talking about like, we got to move beyond the basics. And there was a section in the book that there was several that stuck out to me, but the one that I'm going to ask about was J-Lo. Cause I think in the beginning, you mentioned J-Lo. There were a couple things you said. I think the first reference that I can remember was J-Lo, like, I love her, but like, I'm not,
I don't want to be her.
Right? Yeah, hell no. J-Lo gets so much hate. I don't want her life at all.
Exactly. And so obviously with our brand, Rich and Regular, it was like, all right, she gets it, right? That's exactly kind of the same energy that we bring. Was like, yo, the only thing better than being rich and famous is being rich and regular. Like, I'm not trying to do none of that other stuff. But there was another reference that I really loved because you said what happens when Jenny from the Block becomes Jenny with the Bag.
Yeah.
And I felt, because I knew exactly what you meant when you said that, because look, I mean, like, we're Black, our Black community, like, there's comedians that talk about that particular dynamic around like being a smarty op blank, you know what I mean? All of that, like, there's an energy that comes with that. But like, I want you to kind of break down what that means and like why you decided to use that particular example.
Well, you know, I think it's an experience that I've had to navigate that I didn't even realize I was signing up for as part of this whole process of building wealth. You know, wealth is still very white. Like, it's just perceived as this thing that white people do. And so when you're a person of color that achieves it, you're automatically othered because you're somehow removed from the struggle. You know, you're not relatable anymore. And, you know, I posed a question in the book, like, what do we do when the community that we have been told to escape from no longer welcomes us because we're not part of it anymore? You know what I mean? You come back to the hood and you're just like, everybody's looking at you funny because you got the nice bag or you got the new car or, you know, you got the fancy six-figure job. And there's a lot of this sense of wealth guilt of like, who am I to be the one that made it out? Why am I so lucky to be privileged? And especially when you're confronted back in your hometown and you see the glaring examples of what that does not look like, and it's people that you care about, I think it sends a lot of people into therapy. And they were not prepared for the emotions that come with being the one that made it out. It's the survivor's guilt. You know, and I see that manifest itself in a lot of different ways, whether that's now you feel like you got to be the savior for your family. You have all this unnecessary pressure that you put on yourself to be the one that everybody can call to bail them out of financial emergencies. And unfortunately, many times that comes at the detriment of your own financial safety. But I think there's a lot of this shame and guilt of even being able to achieve this stuff that I want people to understand, if they're feeling that, it's normal. Because you are the first and it's uncomfortable, but it's okay. You know, there's somebody's got to be the first.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, my brain goes so many places when you're talking, because when I think about wealth building as a Black or a brown person, the level of resilience and stamina that it requires, because we make systemically less money for every swing, for every hour, for every contribution and output that we have. And we tend to talk about wealth gaps in terms of Black and white. We're only comparing, you know, a Black woman to a white man and learning that we make 60 something cents on the dollar. But the reality is it's a multiracial issue. It involves brown people too. The people that are making less money than Black women are Hispanic women.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that you're talking about this. I'm glad that you're talking about and addressing the guilt that comes with making it, when we should actually be celebrating it. We should be encouraging these people to be more vocal about what they've done to overcome the massive amounts of uphill struggle that comes with having to work twice as hard for literally close to half as much.
Yeah. I always tell people that it's just like, if it feels hard, it's supposed to, because you're being asked to pursue the American dream on half of the budget.
Correct.
Essentially. And so, yeah, that shit's hard. And you're exhausted. And there's a reason why.
Which is why the plan has to incorporate a way to get you rest. It has to incorporate assets that you can use that produce cash versus you always selling your labor and your time.
Yeah.
I'm asking this question, even bringing it up, because I'm curious if you see any bright spots. Like, is there any place or personality or even generation, area, region? You can slice it however you want, but are there places where you see progress, or do you think we're still at the very beginning of addressing this and making it so vocal that the decisions that we've made are autopilot for teenagers and the kids that are coming behind us?
Yeah, I definitely think there is this shift that's happening. I see reports in the media that more and more Latinas are investing, that women as a whole are becoming homeowners more often than men, that women are better investors if they look at, you know, just the performance of their portfolios versus men. And so I think there's so much, we're kind of like at the beginning, we're still on that climb. And I think what's happening is this is kind of the foundation setting, if you will. There's so many incredible influencers who are using their lived experience and their knowledge to educate folks in communities who have been largely ignored. And so the democratization of the education that's happening, I think, is starting that shift. I'm very excited for the next generation, where these conversations will be much more normalized, where they'll have access to resources that they can relate to. You're not just going to have to be like, go read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. You know, like, we need more options at this point. And so I'm so glad to see more and more, especially Latina money influencers who are putting out books and who are increasing the level of diversity in the conversations, because there is so much cultural baggage that comes with money. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the mainstream personal finance media still doesn't acknowledge how many disparities affect different groups, the intersections of not just like race, but gender and, you know, sexual identity. And just like, there's so many different things that impact your money. And we need to be cognizant of the fact that this whole bullshit narrative of just like, work harder, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, is frankly racist. And that shit needs to stop.
Yeah, it's racist, it's ableist, it's ageist, it's sexist, it's all the ists and isms.
Yes. Yeah.
And what I love about this new generation is that they've kept the emotion. They're still moved by the disparities, but they're no longer like directing it inward. I think for our generation, we directed the shame and the anger and the guilt to ourselves or to our family members. And this next generation is putting it where it belongs, in the institutions that are responsible for setting these rates. And that's, to me, that's inspiring, because it's like, it gives me a reason to keep going and to keep educating them on how it used to be, how it currently is, what hurdles you need to watch out for and navigate as you go through your own version of it. And hopefully they don't lose that fire, you know? Hopefully they continue to put that anger where it belongs and advocate for change.
Yeah.
I think those lived examples that we're seeing, people, you know, just seeing more representation of what it looks like to be a Black or a brown person with wealth, I think it's making that switch for people, where it used to be very easy to just fall into the victim mentality and just be like, well, that's just not for us because nobody's doing this. Whereas now there's more examples of like, oh, she did it. I could do that shit too. And there is very, very powerful force in representation that I think is really motivating people to get out of that victim mentality and just be like, nah, you know what? Despite everything that's going on, I'm still going to give myself the benefit of the doubt and know that I can achieve what I want to achieve.
Yes. Yeah.
Can we talk about Puerto Rico?
Oh, yay. I love Puerto Rico. It's my favorite topics.
Okay. Let's do it. Help me connect the dots, all right?
Yep.
So first, and let me give you some context here because you're helping me out. My son's favorite song, at least one of his top three right now, is Mia, Bad Bunny.
Oh, yes.
oh, my God.
Yeah, he is fluent when that's fluent. I love it.
Whenever it comes on, we play baseball to it. We ride it to the ballpark. That's his hype song.
He gets so good.
Amped. He loves it. It gave me a reason to start doing a little bit more research on Bad Bunny. I remember trying to understand his influence and his music about a year or two ago. And then I got sidetracked and then I was like, I'll come back to it. But now is a really good time because, like I said, our son is vibing to me and we're talking to you. And I'm curious if you can kind of help maybe some of the other people that might be watching or listening kind of connect the dots a little bit, because I feel like there is something to be said about Puerto Rico, Puerto Rican culture, and the role that he plays in terms of influencing pride and people's willingness to think differently about some of the things that you talk about, like in a similar way where Jay-Z and the influence that he had on hip hop sort of created a sense of boss mentality and like, you got to go out there and get yours. Like you got to be willing to hustle. Like, is that what Bad Bunny represents? Or like, how do you think about the role that he plays like culturally in terms of representing Puerto Rico and everything that Puerto Ricans kind of stand for and like what's possible?
Yeah, I love this question. So if y'all don't know, this tattoo that I have is one of his albums. And it stands for Yo Hago Lo Que Me Da La Gana. And so that translates into I do whatever I want. And I think that's his brilliance. He said, I'm going to make music in Spanish and the world's going to listen to it. I'm going to paint my nails. I'm going to do gender bending things. I'm going to break stereotypes. I'm not going to conform. And I think by him doing that, he's given so many people permission to also redefine like who they want to be, how they want to show up, what spaces they're allowed to be in. You know, this man is performing Spanish music as the opener to the Grammys, like never before seen. He's sold out concerts in Spanish language music in ways that no other artist has been able to do. He refused to do the bullshit crossover stuff that so many Latin artists before him were forced to do just to become palatable to the American market. You know, I think he's just a living example of like what it looks like to say, I'm going to do shit on my own. I'm going to create my own rules. You know, I don't need to follow this prescription of like what other people have done before me to find success. I'm going to redefine what that means for me and I'm going to do it authentically. And I think it's kind of like a hallmark too of, especially like Puerto Rican culture. We have a very unique place in the world, like Latin America in general, just because we have automatic American citizenship. And so our lived experience is not like any other immigrant community. We're not immigrants. We're born Americans. And that's one thing that people don't fucking understand. It's like, no, I had a social since birth. Thank you. I could go to Puerto Rico and New Jersey back and forth without any kind of paperwork. And yet coming from that place, which has such a unique relationship with the United States as an actual modern day colony, there are very much like similar experiences to what other folks from other Latin American places will experience, like poverty, you know, racism, gentrification, like all of that stuff is happening over there. But I think our really close tie to America gives Puerto Ricans easier access to the American dream. And so because of that privilege, I think oftentimes we do feel this sense of like, well, I'm going to take this and run with it. And I've seen so many examples of that in my own community, you know, my family, friends who are from Puerto Rico. Like, we will figure some shit out. we will hustle our way to success. And one of the things that I see happening more often is like younger folks, the younger generation is coming back to the island, whereas the older generation used to leave to, you know, have better opportunities. And now people like myself who are realizing, you know, the place that we love is actually going to fall apart if we don't actually come back and start pouring back into it. There's sort of this like redirection of the diaspora back home so that we can create our version of the American dream over there. And it's really powerful to see.
Is that what influenced your desire to buy property there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think back to just the fact that my parents made this incredibly difficult decision that I could never imagine making, of just like, I'm going to go to a place where I don't know the language. I don't know anyone. I don't know how this is going to work. And hopefully it pays off. And it absolutely did. But there was a huge sacrifice that had to come with that, right? This disconnection from your community. You know, my mom raised us by herself. She didn't have the aunties and the grandma and everybody around. And so I felt almost this sense of like, I kind of want to reclaim what was given up for the fact that now I've been able to do all of this incredible stuff. Because I acknowledge in the book, none of what I've been able to accomplish would have been possible in Puerto Rico, where more than half of the population is in poverty, and where a lot of dreams die. And I've seen that with my cousins, with family members. My life would be completely different. And so the fact that they made that really incredibly difficult decision to give me the opportunities that I've had, I wanted to bring it back home. I wanted to for us to have a sort of a representation of the sacrifices were worth it. And that's what that condo represents. Like every time my family's on vacation there, my sister just got back and she's just like, I haven't been to Puerto Rico in 15 years. And this experience changed me. I feel reconnected to my culture in a way that I didn't even know was possible. And so there's not even a price you can put on the sacrifice that they made. And that's our little family vacation home that now represents that it was all worth it.
You mentioned your sister feeling different, feeling changed. I was curious if you felt the same way. Once you started splitting your time between the two places, did you feel like there was a missing piece that was finally like put back?
Abso-freaking-lutely. Ever since I can remember as a kid, I used to get these messages of just like, oh, you talk like a white girl, or oh, you're so nerdy, you're so smart. Like I always just felt like I was this weird kid who wasn't Puerto Rican enough, but a little too white. I didn't feel comfortable being Latina in the workplace. You know, there's a lot of code switching going on, just feeling like you don't want to be too loud, abrasive. You don't want people to start thinking like, oh, there's a, you know, token Latina girl, don't know how to act. So there was always this feeling of like that part of my identity had to be reserved for family functions, you know, for the birthdays, the weddings, whatever. I could not be Puerto Rican Janice, like in public, in school, in whatever. And so not only has my journey into entrepreneurship helped me reclaim my identity, because every single business that I've had has been centered on my Latinidad, whether we're talking about the food blog or the personal finance brand, now the book, like it's all just hella unapologetically Latina. And something about being an owner in the island where my family is from just makes me feel like I have a vested interest in making sure that what's going on there, you know, gets addressed, because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in Puerto Rico. Most notably how many people are like recolonizing it in this new century with tax benefits and buying up real estate and making it impossible for people who are local to the island to afford to live there. And so there's this sense of like now stewardship and responsibility that comes with being able to be a part of that community in a way that even my parents haven't been able to, you know?
I'm going to ask you a difficult question. At least I feel like it would be difficult for me, but do you feel like there are parts of your culture that you've had to leave behind in order to get where you are?
Oh God. Ooh. Okay. Yes. We still do struggle. Too, right? Yeah. I'm like, oh, shit.
I got choked up just thinking about it, too.
Damn.
And if you need me to give you some context, I can. But, like, I feel like that's kind of where you are. And it sucks because, like, there's pride and there's joy in what you're doing and there's purpose behind it. But I think as we go through this process of self-examination and also just examining our environment, and you find a path, you're one of the few people to find a path. Like, you realize that, oh, in order for me to get to the end of that path, I can't bring everything with me.
Yeah.
There's some things and some people and some beliefs that I need to leave behind. And I'm asking out of my own curiosity, but also because I think, and I think you know this, that's what people struggle with. It's not that they don't know better. It's not that they're not smart people and not that they're not talented. It's that they can't find a way to get to where they want to go while holding on to who they are. That's the whole, that's what makes it hard. But, like, I'm curious, like, what, if anything, have you had to leave behind in order to get where you're going?
I think it's a lot of the mindset stuff more than anything. It's kind of like the collective trauma of poverty is like one of those things that it just makes people play very small. It makes them afraid to take risks. It makes them afraid to, like, rock the boat. Right. So, like, simple little things that I heard growing up was like, don't switch jobs because it makes you look flaky.
Put your head down.
You know, like, going. Once you're there, just stay there. And I think about how my own trajectory from, like, making 40 something thousand dollars when I graduated to making 100 grand within like 7 years, there's no way that would have happened if I'd followed that advice. And so I had to kind of get really okay with, like, respecting people's opinions, but also not thinking that, like, it's Bible. You know, and it was another conversation too when I was going to quit my job. Obviously, I'm going to tell my parents, you know, they're like, what's going on? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to quit my job. And they're just like, but, like, why don't you just do both? And I'm like, I'm working 27 hours a day. This is not sustainable. But, you know, it's always goes back to, like, oh, what are you going to do for, like, health insurance, or what are you going to do for your retirement, and blah, blah. So there's just, like, so much fear that keeps people from taking calculated risk. And I think there's just, again, this goes back to the lack of representation.
That's
if you don't know anybody who is investing, you're going to be like, hell no, we're going to play the lottery. That's safe because everybody's doing that. We don't invest. What is that? Or you fall into that narrative where home ownership is the only way to build wealth. And if you're renting, you're wasting money. It's just, there's so much mindset stuff that keeps us from doing the things that we know we should be doing. But that's why I dedicate a lot of the book to also conversations around mental health and trauma and just, like, addressing those money beliefs. Because if you don't get to the root of that stuff, I could tell you how to build a $1 million portfolio, but you ain't going to do none of it. Because you've got baggage you need to address first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it compounds when we aren't represented or we are underrepresented, because even our communities, our friends and families, the people we rely on for cheerleading and support, they only see this one version of what wealth does.
Mm-hmm.
And that version is what you were just describing. It colonizes, it raises the prices, it takes advantage of our local resources and uses too many of them. Versus your story, which is like, no, I am taking my wealth and building a moat. I'm coming back to defend what needs to be preserved, and I'm changing alongside with it. And I think a lot of people don't see money as a means to self-actualization. They just see it as a means to buying a bigger something, a fancier this or that.
Yeah.
And more of us need to be talking about neuroplasticity and mental health and wellness and how you can use your money to find that missing piece. And you realize that the amount of money that you spend on a condo in Puerto Rico, there's no amount of bags or car that could have given you that feeling, but you chased it for, at least I did. I don't want to project, but, like, I chased the fact that I could buy it through other things versus discovering it and finding it and exchanging my money as energy to really fulfill, to find this sense of fulfillment. It's like, it opens up the emotional spectrum beyond just the limited words that we use. And stories like this always get me excited, because it's like, yes, I need this book to sell. I need people to pre-order it. I need to send a message to the publishing industry that this is what people need. This is what people want. This is the truth. This is what matters going into the next century. We only have to go that far, next decade.
Like, when you think about like how hard people of color work, we should have so much more to show for it. That's the thing for me. It's just like, we got to acknowledge first, yeah, there's systemic shit at play. Like, let's not be ignorant to that. But we have so much collective power, and it's about damn time that we started educating ourselves, because nobody else is going to do it for us, and start doing something different, because what has gotten us here is not what's going to get us to the next place that we need to go.
Correct. And we need to scale those lessons. You know, through our musical artists, through our creators, through writers, through videographers, we need to be able to scale these stories in a way that people have access to them without needing to enroll in a university or, you know, have a one-on-one mastermind with me. Like, the game is out there. We just need to encourage people to keep adding, even, you know, as we get to the next levels within our own businesses and lives. Like, I plan to keep adding to the repository, whether it's monetized or not. Like, the point is to leave behind breadcrumbs and advice and guidance so that it's always there. Mm-hmm. I love the example of Ramit's book, because you're right. It's been evergreen. The lessons are still valid. And 10 years later, he gets to get on TV and scale the message even further. And so it's like, if you're interested in a long game, this is exactly what it requires. It just requires being the truth and being willing to say it as often and as loudly as possible.
Yes. Emphasis on the loud.
Right.
What part of the book scares you the most as you were writing it?
Ooh, God. Well, I know my parents have read the book, and there weren't too many awkward conversations of that, which I was happy to see. But I think, I don't know if I'm scared, but definitely the most vulnerable part of the book was kind of letting folks into the toxic, chaotic marriage that I was in while I'm like building wealth. And I think that whole chapter, well, first of all, it wasn't even meant to be part of the book. Like, I was still married when I was writing the book, and then I got divorced in the process of it. So there was not even a plan to include a chapter about like love and money. But through the process of divorce, it was a really eye-opening experience that I'm like, I need to let more women in on what I did to protect my own wealth. Because as soon as people started hearing that part of the story, they're just like, wait, what? A prenup, postnup, what are you talking about? This is not something we do in our community.
Yeah.
And it opened up a whole conversation about what it means to be a woman who's building wealth in the 21st century, which I have to remind people, you know, the reason why we haven't had to talk about this before is because we actually couldn't do this. One generation ago, we couldn't do this. So we are actually living in a time as the first generation of women who are even able to build wealth that needs to be protected and passed on. So, you know, the fact that your grandmother never told you about a prenup, yeah, this makes sense, because she couldn't buy a fucking house on her own. You know, she couldn't get a credit card on her own. She couldn't get a bank account on her own. But that's been really, I think it surprises me how much resonance that part of the conversation has had, because it is awkward. It's weird, but it's also so necessary because of the times that we're living in. So I'm hoping that that chapter especially like encourages couples to have more conversations about money, especially given the fact that money is one of the leading reasons why people get divorced. Like, we cannot afford to not have these conversations at this point.
100% agree. I think it resonates with our audience as well. Some of the most popular episodes that we've done have explored divorce and prenups and preparing for marriage and a way to be a couple but still have your individual protections in place. Like, to your point, I feel like a lot of people are just hearing it for the first time, and it feels, it's not uncomfortable, but it feels like, how did I miss this? Like, how did I... How come nobody said this to me? And, you know, unless you're a student of history, then you don't know why people didn't say it. It was not an option, nor did it matter as much when women weren't making as much money or dealing with the things that we're dealing with now. And so, yeah, I agree.
Well, look, we said it at the top. We'll say it again at the end. We're proud of you. You wrote an excellent book, a powerful book.
Thank you.
Spicy, funny. Like, I really, really enjoyed reading it. And I think a lot of other people will enjoy it as well. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about your book and you?
Absolutely. So you can order the book at financiallylitbook.com. I also have the audiobook version, which I personally narrated. And I cannot wait for folks to get their hands on this, because I think for the first time, especially people in the Latino community are going to feel spoken to in a way about money that nobody else has done. And I hope that this is just the beginning of what the, what I call in the book, the financial revolution looks like.
That's hot. Thank you, Shanice.